Okay, February 17th, 2014, Writers Workshop Part 2. I just, some books here. Did you find this one?
I'm looking, no, I just connected.
Okay, this book, The Writer's Art by Kilpatrick, read the first name.
James J. Kilpatrick.
Yes, thank you, James. This is a classic in just general writing, terms, structure. I would suggest you read it at least 5 times. I'm very seriously. I'd suggest you read it until you can breathe it, and it's part of you, and you never need to read it again because it's just osmosis has pervaded you. Okay. It's just a general writing book. This is the one I was referring to about that company that they got the Dream Manager by Matthew Kelly. It's a really quick read. By the way, this book is also a very good example, along with these two down here, of writing technique. So not only is the message of The Dream Giver by Matthew Kelly a very interesting message as far as how to deal with people and how to be a leader, but he's done this, he's given his message almost entirely, 90%, in the form of a narrative, in the form of a story. And it gives you some idea of how to communicate a powerful message in an unusual way. And these two books I put down here also for that purpose. The Dream Giver by Dr. Bruce Wilkinson. He's a Christian writer. These are both Christian writers. And he's teaching a very powerful message through fable. So first Bruce Wilkinson and The Dream Giver gives you a fable, and then he gives you an analysis of his fable. And the Screwtape Letters is also a very innovative writing technique by C.S. Lewis, who you've probably heard of with the Narnia stories. So Screwtape Letters is a series of letters from a chief demon to a minor demon. And telling how to bewilder a human being and how to take a human being away from God. So everything's backwards. They refer to God as, you know, our enemy below, our enemy above, and the devil is, you know, our father below. And everything in there is backwards. So what's good is bad, and what's bad is good. And it's an incredible psychological study, again, of the neophyte devotee, and what is the path, the beginning path of bhakti. But his writing technique is so clever, and it's very engaging. Some of these other ones here, these three here, they're geared more to the speaker rather than the writer, but the principles would apply. Chip and Dan Heath have two books, Made to Stick and Switch. Made to Stick is a really good book that gives you step-by-step guidance for how to give a speech or how to write an essay so people will remember what you taught them. And Switch is how to get people to change their attitudes and or behavior. And again, it gives you formulas and guidelines. If you follow these, you'll be very, very effective in your writing, and you can also, of course, use these for speaking. Dr. Bruce Wilkinson, The 7 Laws of the Learner, he's giving you a lot of the principles, how to teach to people's needs, how to teach so that people will apply what you've learned. And again, this can be used for either speaking or writing. If you're really interested, there is a DVD set. Of course, he is a Christian, and there is going to be some Christian stuff in this. Now, I've taught this to a whole community along with the GBC. And what we did was we would show part of the videos and then teach it. And then I've also taught it without videos, just on my own in London. We had a 16 sessions of 2 hours each. So we had one session to learn the theory, and then one session to practice, and one session to learn the theory, and one session to practice. I also teach individual modules of this. So I just teach, you know, how to teach to people's needs, how to teach so people will apply, how to teach so people will remember, and so forth. Obviously, I don't have time to do all that now. So I would really suggest that you study this. Then Communicating for a Change by Andy Stanley. Now, Andy Stanley is also a Christian preacher, and he obviously read and imbibed 7 Laws of the Learner. You know, you can tell that he's basing what he's done on Dr. Wilkinson. Dr. Wilkinson, by the way, is, of anybody that I've met in the Hare Krishna movement, out of the Hare Krishna movement, theist, atheist, the most amazing, empowered teacher. I simply have not met a more amazing, empowered teacher. His techniques for teaching the truths of the Bible and knowledge of the Bible are just absolutely incredible. This guy is really, really, really empowered. I mean, unfortunately, he's sort of into karma yoga instead of bhakti yoga, but he's really, really an empowered teacher, and there's so much you can learn from him. And I know a lot of devotees who use a lot of his insights in their own writing and their own teaching. So I highly, highly, highly recommend it with just no reservations at all. I mean, you have to be aware he's going to use Christian allusions. He's going to allude to stories in the Bible and so forth. But other than that, the principles that he's teaching are completely spot on, and he's really an expert. And the programs that he's put together to teach people the Bible and teach people Christian principles based on his understandings here are just wonderful. I'm hoping someday we can do that for our own scriptures and for Srila Prabhupada's books to that extent that he's done. So these are some references. All right, so what did we talk about so far? We talked about that you have to know your audience, you have to know what they need, that you have to follow this, right? And this is right from Dr. Wilkins Sembo, to reading right here. This is the internal process that your reader should be going through as they're reading what you write. Now, we're talking primarily here about, you know, an essay, but it could be also in the form of a narrative. We're talking about something that's fairly short. We're not talking about a novel or a 500-page book, which would have a little different trajectory, because you're not going to have a 500-page book and give people what they need only in the last 20 pages, right? It's going to be structured a little differently. But here we're talking about a short piece. Yes, most of what we're writing is short pieces. This needs to be the psychological process that your readers go through. This needs to be the psychological process that your readers go through. Curse of knowledge is talked a lot about by Chip and Dan Heath. How to get free of the curse of knowledge, which is... It's such a huge problem I see in devotees' writing. Such a huge problem. That they assume that people want to know what they want to say, and they assume that people already have the background knowledge that they have. Right? Even I had that here, and you had to say to me, no, people don't know that. Right? It's so common. We're not aware of our own, of what are our own assumptions in our life. All right, another... way you can think of structuring, which comes right from Andy Stanley, and is another way to understand this. This is right from Andy Stanley. That's basically the same thing that I told you before, but in another little different structure. So this is especially if your readers don't really know you. You know, if you're doing the regular column, you may not have to do this. But here you're sort of introducing yourself, but you're introducing yourself as having the same felt need or the same problem that they have. It's a little easier than getting right into, you know, you don't want to get, one thing you don't want to do, oh my God, you don't want to go, you all have this problem, don't you? Please don't do that. And nor do you don't come right out with just the problem. So I'm sure a lot of you are really having problems in your relationships. Ooh, do. That's not what I mean. Okay. Remember we talked about bringing out the feeling. So it's very good to start with me. It's good for your humility and for your connection and to make it real. To make it real.
Gotta be real.
People are not interested in something that's not authentic. So it's good to start with me. You don't always have to start with me. You can start with we. But don't start with you. Start with we. You know, that I lived in the ashram and I worried about what would happen when I would get old. Or, you know, I was... And you can start out with some dialogue, also a little story. That, you know, I heard a story about so-and-so who dedicated her life to spirituality, and then when she got old, she was just put in an old age home and nobody went to see her. And I was wondering, you know, is that what's going to happen to me? Is no one going to care about me anymore? And we may find that we're so concerned, we may find that we're so concerned when our children have to go to college and it's going to be so expensive and working so hard and how am I going to have time for my spiritual life? And we're just thinking, oh, someday in the future, they'll finally get all my debts paid off and all my obligations done, and then I can go to Vrindavan and just chant Hare Krishna. Okay. You follow? And we look at the people who seem to just have no anxieties about these things, and we wonder, how did they do that? We see some people who just seem to go on serving Krishna without ever worrying about their maintenance and their security. So then, what does God say about it? What does the Shastra say? So, of course, for that, you have to know the Shastra. Radical idea. We also get a lot of articles to back to Godhead by people who obviously don't know the Shastra. They have nothing in there from the Shastra. I say read widely, but my dear friends, that has to be your cherry on the top of the icing on the top of the cake. So you don't want something just from modern psychology, and you don't want just something just from modern sociology or just from your own experience. That doesn't have any value. So we get some people who just quote Shastra. The whole thing is just one quote after another. We get some of that. But more often we get people who don't have any reference to Shastra or don't have any grounding in Shastra, or they just tell some sort of story, or, you know, it's just a string of stories. So how does Krishna say? What does Krishna say is the answer to the problem? What does he say to do? How does he say to deal with it? How does Krishna deal in the Bhagavad Gita with this problem about worrying for security? Because,
Sarandantini.
Was that all he says? What else does he say? He says, Nir Yogakshema Atmavan, in 243 or 45. And then he says, Yogakshema Vahamyaham, in 922. Both Yogakshema. And he talks over and over again. Krishna talks about this. Don't be worried about gain and safety. Fight for the sake of fighting. So, and then how do you do that? And Prabhupada's talking about in the purports about how you do that and how the sadhus done it and how do other people do it. What does that mean? What am I going to be? What do I have to do? Okay, so this is the theory, you could say. Here we're getting into the principles and the theories. I don't mean theories in the sense that they're not true. Do you follow what I'm saying? The concepts, you could say. They're called concepts. The principles, the concepts, the idea. And here we're getting into the concrete and the specifics. Please give people specifics, folks. Please, 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 please. Don't just tell people, just be Krishna conscious. Don't tell people, just chant Hare Krishna. Don't tell people that. New people won't know what to do, and old people will roll their eyes at you. If you said to me, Urmila, the solution to all your problems is to be Krishna conscious. Okay. Right? And if someone's new, they'll just go, oh, what do I do with that? When I first visited, the second time I visited a temple, I asked the devotee, I said, I love this philosophy, what can I do to practice it? And she didn't tell me anything. She said, we don't have any room in the ashram. You'll have to get your own apartment. That's all she told me. I mean, that was my lack of sukriti, my bad karma. But, you know, don't do that to people. And so the new people don't know what to do. They have no idea what to do. And the people who've been around for a while go, you know, can you give me step by step by step? What do I do? And you want to give people what do I do in preferably all three areas. Behaviors, thoughts, and feelings. Right? Thinking, feeling, willing. Thinking, feeling, willing. What do I do? What do I do on the bodily level? How do I change my thoughts? What do I do with my feelings and desires? Behavior and desires. And then here, give them a nice picture. Here you gave them the picture of the problem. Here you give them the picture of the solution. Just reading how Prithvi Maharaj treated his wife like half of his body. Suppose all the husbands in his country treated their wife as half of their body. What kind of a society would it be? What kind of a society would it be? You're always nice to half your body. Anybody mean to half their body? I don't like this half of my body. So that's the bottom we. The bottom we is a vision. It's a vision. What could it be like? All right? Any questions so far? Because now we're going to go on to a very, 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 very different area of writing.
Is there a maximum length an article should be?
That's entirely up to the magazine editors.
For me personally, if I read something that's more than 2 pages, I get bored. In a magazine situation.
Generally, though, that means that it's not such engaging writing. Although, what's happening now with the internet, I'm going to hesitate to say, but probably, is our interest in reading long things is decreasing. You know, I find personally with the internet, and I've been a reader my whole life. I've been a crazy reader my whole life. I love to read. But I found with the internet, you read something and then you go to something else, and then you read something and you go to something else. And to stay with something for a long time is very difficult. When I read on my Kindle, which has no connection with the internet, I can't get online with this. Well, I can get online to buy a book from Amazon, but I can't, like, get online. Then I can just read. Then I can read for hours, like I used to. But most of us, especially younger people, who maybe never even had that experience, they've only read online. They're not used to reading something long. I was just, my son wants to write a nonfiction book, and he asked me to do some research. And one place I read said, don't have the book be more than 100 pages, which is a small book. I mean, I just published like a 97-page book on chanting Hare Krishna. And one of the, it got just got translated into Portuguese, and they were selling it in Brazil and having me sign copies, which was really cool. I was definitely enjoying that. But one of the devotees, more than one of the devotees, came up to me and said, what I really like about the book is that it's short. I said, wow, you said in just a few words what other people take 500 pages to say. It's like, oh, that's interesting. So people are going with shorter. Definitely. In BTG, our maximum length is usually 2,500 words. In Back to Godhead, that's a full-length article. And our photo articles are maximum 1,200 words. It's pretty hard to develop an idea in less than 700 to 1,000 words. When I used to do the education column, they wanted it to be on one page. You know, that was 700 to 1,000 words. And that's a real challenge to develop an idea. One of the more interesting bits of writing that I did was when I was writing for ISKCON Interactive, which is a multimedia map of ISKCON, all different areas. Hardly anybody has that, but it's so I love showing it on my computer because hardly anybody has ever seen it. It's something new. But the way that they structured it was there were all different topics, and you had to fit it into a box on the screen. So, okay, explain karma in a box. Gave me a new appreciation for the people who write the things in museums that are on the... I never thought about it before. Yeah, you just, what is a tiger? And you explain it in this little box, and I appreciate it now. And because just one letter off, then it would be off the box. So you had to structure your, where you put your words and which words you used and things like that to try to, that's, it's a good exercise to do that kind of thing, by the way, to try to make a complex point in a few sentences. Another good exercise is writing poetry. If you write good poetry, it makes you use all of the literary ornaments, which you can then bring to your prose. Anything else? On what I've already talked about, because I'm going to talk about other things now. Yeah.
And this two methods that you gave us, the God, you, and the other one, I'm thinking how to apply to different types of articles. Like, for example, I'm supposed to write about Afroforum, British people's visit to South Africa in general. So how would I take something like that?
How does Ambarisha's visit to South Africa relate to people's, to the things people worry about when they go through their day? That's your first question. How does it? How does Ambarisha's visit to South Africa relate to what people worry about and think about and hope for and dream about in their day? I'm asking.
Well, he's successful.
Okay.
Money.
Okay. So here's somebody who's both materially successful and a devotee. Okay, that might be one angle. That might be one angle. Oh, I should have said, one angle per article. One point per article. One, only one, only one, 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 not two, not three, not
Thank
ten,
you.
One
Thank
point
you.
Per article. One. Point per article. One. It can have subpoints, it can have subpoints, but you one point that you can write in a sentence that is a statement. One, 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 one per article, per speech. One. Only one. There's lots of time. We're all eternal. You can make your other points later. The worst. The worst class I ever went to was a devotee giving a Sunday feast class where he tried to teach the whole philosophy in 45 minutes. The result is he taught nothing. So that could be one angle. One angle could be that people are definitely interested in how can I beat most people. There are a few devotees that don't care about whether or not they're a success in the world. There are a handful of devotees like that. But the vast majority of people do not want to be a material failure. They just don't. Whether they should or they shouldn't feel that way, that's how they feel. I don't want to be a material failure. Anybody here want to be a material failure? You don't care. Careful. So most of us really, you know, I really don't. I mean, if Krishna does, okay, we accept it. But it's not like I don't care. I can't say I don't care. I do care. I don't want to live on the street with only a blanket. I don't want to. I mean, if Krishna does that to me, then I'll try to accept and be happy with that. But that's not what I want. I want to have reasonable health. I want to have a decent, clean place to go to sleep. You know, I want to have a clean set of clothes to put on in the morning. I want that. Now, I may not want to be as rich as Ambarish, but I want to have a material life that's reasonably comfortable and successful. And most people do. Yes? Yes? We're not supposed to admit this in the Hare Krishna movement. We're not allowed to admit that that's how we feel. But I also want to be Krishna conscious. And throughout Srila Prabhupada's books, he talks about how to be, and Krishna talks about, third chapter, to live happily and attain liberation, right? Be thou happy by the sacrifice, by which you can live happily and attain liberation. And Prabhupada, throughout his books, talks about how a Krishna conscious society is a materially happy society. And what kind of attractive preaching is it? We're going to make the whole world Krishna conscious and then everybody will live in poverty and distress. Okay. So if we're going to say to people that it's entirely possible to be materially a very successful person, of course, Ambarisha is a little funny because he didn't work for his money. He inherited it. But still, he's a materially successful person in the world. He's a respected person in the world. He hasn't stopped that. He hasn't walked away from it. He hasn't had to renounce it. But he's used it in Krishna's service. And that's a model for how I can use whatever I have in Krishna's service, and I don't have to feel that it's absolutely necessary for me to walk around with only a loincloth eating discarded rice from the gutters of Jagannath Puri in order to be a pure devotee. Yes? Is that real? Is that a real concern? Is that something that maybe keeps some of us from surrendering as much as we could have because we're really afraid if I really surrender, I've got to just wear a loincloth. I mean, a woman, I guess we get to wear a little bit more than that. And just, you know, and just eat the rejected rice in Jagannath Puri. So, yeah, that could be one angle. That could be one angle. Then Ambarish is giving us a very practical example. Okay? Well, it could be another angle that ties into people's real concerns. Do people want to know the answer to that question? Do they? Do new people want to know the answer to that question? If I become a devotee of Krishna, do I have to live in the street and eat rejected rice?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Do people who've been devotees 20, 30, 40 years want to know the answer to that question?
Yes.
Yes. So you've got a broad audience, okay? You're going to be hitting the real needs and real concerns of a broad audience with this example. What other need could you hit on? What other theme could you get?
Whatever position we are, we can still make a contribution.
Oh, okay. Making a contribution with our talents and our abilities. That's also huge. That's also huge. I find a misunderstanding often among devotees that if I like what I do and I'm good at what I do, then it's Maya. Which is a really strange idea of God, you know, that the surrender God wants you to do is to be miserable. So that... That Ambarish has his talents, he has his abilities, he has his money, and we can also make that. We can also make some contribution with whatever we have. Whatever we have, something to contribute. Okay, good. Another angle, and that's not the same theme. It's a different theme. It's related, but it's not the same. What would be another one?
Well, overall, looking at the Hare Krishna news, it's directed towards Hindus and people interested in that at least.
Okay.
I would say the Vedic planetarium itself, the temple itself.
What does that have to do with people's needs and worries and concerns when they're going through their day?
Well, there's some magnificent place to worship, which Hindus, I think, appreciate.
What are their needs and concerns?
Is there a God?
Is there a God? Okay.
So that's like a kind of symbolic manifestation. God in a certain line of belief.
But the temple is there to just fulfill our desires, material desires.
Give me a need and concern.
The harmony between science and religion.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Now this ties into, it's related to, but again, it's not the same as, can I be both materially successful and Krishna conscious? It's very related, although it's not exactly the same. And you'd come at it from a different angle. Because especially many of the Hindus are up there in the maths and the sciences. Yes? And especially many of the ethnic Indian Hindus, they don't want to be known as ignorant, uncivilized fools, you know, still hanging on to this primitive religion. Yes? Am I correct? So then it would be of some interest that, and this particularly for Indian Hindus, I think you can go at it with this angle if this is your main audience. That here we can see how India has really contributed to science and mathematics, how there's a scientific basis for our beliefs, that they're not just a bunch of superstitious myths about, you know, elephant-headed creatures. And it's not just some weird, superstitious, mythological stories that your grandmother tells and has nothing to do with rockets going into outer space. So I think there's a need, that we have a need for authenticity. We have a need for understanding and knowledge, and people are concerned that they want to make sure that what they believe in also makes logical sense and is scientifically sound.
Also, people have a desire to be successful.
Yes.
And Ambarish personifies a different perspective on success.
Well, I think that's almost the same thing. That was what we talked about, to be a successful person. If you can't tie what you're writing about to somebody's needs, you shouldn't write it. Writing about the Temple of the Vedic Planetarium, because I think you should be interested in the Temple of the Vedic Planetarium, please don't do that. Those articles are boring, 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 and more boring, and just show that we're, you know, irrelevant. You can always relate any spiritual topic to people's real needs. You must be able to. Otherwise, what's the value of our spiritual philosophy if it doesn't relate to people's real needs? If we say, here's a topic that doesn't relate to anybody's real needs, what are we saying? Here's a topic you should read, but it has nothing to do with anything you care about. Do you follow? But you should listen and you should pay attention. Well, why? See, what's happening is that it's meeting some need of the writer, but the writer is not aware of what needs it's meeting in them. They haven't articulated it. And perhaps some of this is our own hesitancy to even say that we have desires and we have needs because we're not supposed to or something. Or we're all just supposed to be interested in things just because they're spiritual. But that's not real. I'm not interested in things just because they're spiritual. Just because I'm supposed to. I'm supposed to be interested in this. But interest in something, it's a feeling. You can't be supposed to be interested in something. This doesn't work. I'm supposed to be interested in this. Okay? All right? You know, how long are you going to do that? Then after a while, you'll start reading Krishna conscious stuff and you'll start watching the movies, which are much more engaging than somebody talking about something just because they think you're supposed to. So you want to sometimes, well, why am I interested in this? What's interesting me about this? What's grabbing me about this? Which of my needs is it meeting? And how will this relate to other people? Take the time to do this. Once you get accustomed to it, it'll come so easily to you. But take the time to do this with any topic, especially if you're given a topic. I hate being given a topic. Especially if you're given a topic. What? I have to know my audience. Who are my audience? What are they thinking about? What is going through their mind in the course of a day, in the course of a typical day?
What I have to say about topics is that we, for example, in the Hare Krishna news, we have a standing thing that writers can submit ideas, but rarely do we ever get an idea submitted. Like, rarely.
Usually you assign topics.
Yeah. So in that sort of situation,
It's a little harder. But even when people submit things, they tend not to make them relevant. I mean, we get submissions to Back to God, and hardly one in 50 submissions are written in such a way that they have anything to do with the needs and concerns of the audience. Hardly one in 50. The person writing just assumes that everybody should be interested in what they have to say, because they should be. Because they should be. You know, they'll just start off, there are three modes of material nature. Goodness is like this, passion is like this, ignorance is like, why should I care? Why do I want to know? What good will it do me? How is this going to relate to how I'm, you know, the fact that I have to fix my carburetor? And the fact that I'm worried that my son's going to fail in school? And, you know, what am I going to do with that? And the fact that I have to go to work at 6 in the morning and I'm struggling to chant my rounds at 8 o'clock at night. And what is the most material nature? Well, it has a lot to do with it. But it's the writer's responsibility to take the Shastra and bring it to the person. I see that it's our responsibility. It's like you take the Shastra and you shine light behind it. You make it real for people. It's got to be real for people. And then people will want to be devotees of Krishna. Oh, if I'm a devotee of Krishna, then it gives me the key to everything in my life. And then eventually, of course, you don't have a material life anymore. Your life has become spiritualized. But that's why I spend so much time on this. It's the number one problem. I mean, you can teach people how to write introduction and body and conclusion and put in transitions and have interesting writing styles and use literary ornaments, and I'm not going to teach you that today. But you're writing to communicate, you're writing to have a connection, you're writing for yoga. You're writing for, as Prabhupada said in the teachings of Queen Kunti, soul to soul via the super soul. You want to connect with your reader. You want to connect with your reader, and you want to make it real for your reader. Now, it's true, if I already know Ambarish, which I do, you know, if Ambarish is a friend of mine, then I might be interested in his trip to South Africa. Or if I'm already interested in the temple of the Vedic Planetarium, which I personally am, if I've already been following the design of the temple, if I already have some interest in science and Krishna consciousness, if I've already read all of Satipuddha's books, which I have many more than once, if I've already been involved with the committee discussions about how they're going to do the chandelier, which I have, and I already know all the people that are concerned with it and all the debates going on behind the scenes about what are they going to do, this and that, which I do have. And I've already been to Mayapur and I've already looked at the... Then I'm going to be interested that Ambarish comes and talks about the Vedic Planetarium. You don't have to connect it to my knees because it's already connected. And I might think if I'm writing the article that everybody else also knows Ambarish and everybody else has already read Satipuddha's books three times and already everybody else already has talked to Charnarenu about what the planetarium design is, and everybody else has already argued with Harisari about whether or not we should use Charnarenus or, you know, and not do this. You know, I might think that everybody else has already done that, and therefore they're naturally going to be interested in what I'm interested in, but they're not. You follow? Does that make sense? Ambarish came and talked about the Temple of the Vedic Planetarium. So what? You know, I'm more interested in the stock report. And the, you follow? Okay. All right. Now we're going to about organizing ourselves. So sometimes you write a first draft, the whole first draft in one sitting, if you're like really inspired. I personally do a lot of my pre-writing in my head. I do a lot of my pre-writing when I take japa walks, not when I'm chanting the japa, when I'm taking the walk, not at the same time that I'm chanting the japa, when I'm in a car, when I'm talking to people, when I'm seeing what the headlines in the news are, when I'm listening to a class, when I'm reading a purport, when people are coming to me with their problems, when I'm dealing with my own problems. I'm doing a lot of pre-writing then, and sometimes I can spend 15 years pre-writing an article.
15 years?
Yes, I have spent 15 years pre-writing an article. My article on birth control and back to Godhead was 15 years of preparation.
I remember that article.
Huh?
I remember that article. I love it.
Oh, thank you. It's now very controversial because of one statement in there about homosexuality. It's become a very controversial article. When it was written, homosexuality wasn't a controversial topic. And now it is. So sometimes people will post it on websites and then they always, now they have to put a little disclaimer or they have to take that sentence out. So, you know, I started doing the pre-writing for my article on the elements when I was going swimming and I was going through the water and I was chanting Hare Krishna as I was going through the water and I was meditating on water. And sometimes things just come together and you just sit down and write that first draft and you don't quite know how you did it and it just sort of happens. And other times you write a paragraph and then you go away for a week and then you come back and write another paragraph and then you go away for a month and then you come back and write a whole set of things. So my article's on chanting, which now is the book. So for that, I researched for 1.5 years. So I researched especially through Prabhupada's purports and Bhaktivinoda Thakura's books on chanting and some of the books on chanting that were written by ISKCON devotees. And then I made extensive notes on each of the offenses from all the books and then I compiled it. And then after doing that pre-writing and planning, I went to write each draft. And what I usually do is I usually write most or all of the first draft at one sitting and then I go back and fix it and change it. But sometimes I'll write half and then I'll go back and write the other half and then I'll move things around and I take some time with it. And I find for me, I have to have a resting time. I need to have at least 24 hours after I've so-called finished my first draft before I touch it again. I have to get away from it and get perspective. I would never, ever, 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 ever want to write a first draft, then edit it, then send it in, all the same sitting. And a week is even better. but at least 24 hours rest. We have one writer who, I understand why he does it, but it's actually quite annoying. He'll send in to us for approval a first draft, and then it's really a first draft. He hasn't done the resting, and he hasn't done the editing. It's his first draft. And he makes us editors do that. He makes us do that. And then he sends in his second first draft. And then he sends in up to four or five first drafts. And after a while, you're tired of reading the same article in so many drafts. And you're like, you know, could you please do your own work here? So we definitely have one writer who does that. And I understand why he does it. I mean, it's very helpful to get other people's feedback. He writes, you know, he ends up with beautiful pieces at the end. But, you know, I like to do that myself. Now, sometimes I have friends who are willing to go over stuff for me. I can't ask them with everything I write, or they wouldn't be my friends anymore. But sometimes I will say, you know, would you be willing to review this for me and give me your feedback? Especially if there's certain parts of it that I'm really not sure if it makes sense. But I think each of us has to find our own style of writing. I don't think that my style of writing is going to be your style of writing. Like, each of us have to find our own style of studying. And it's we're very individuals, and we have to work individually. But the one thing I can say for everyone is at least 24-hour break. Get some distance from your writing before you go in and edit. And consider that it's done. That you give yourself, between the time that you say it's done and the time that it's done, give yourself at least 24 hours, preferably even a week. You want to give yourself enough time so you forget what you wrote. You know, so you're reading it like you didn't write it. Because you're trying to read it without any of your assumptions. You know, when we write, we have underlying assumptions that are tying our ideas together. And when we understand the logic of our flow, and it may or may not be obvious to somebody else. Our connections between our ideas are sometimes underground. They're not always clear. And someone else may not understand how we're getting from one point to another, or what one thing has to do with the other. So you want to try to read your article as if you're somebody else. And the only way to do that is to get far enough away from it that you forget what you wrote. And then you can try to read it like a stranger. Now, if you're on a very tight deadline, sometimes that's not possible, and you have to just rely on other people entirely to do that for you. Definitely someone else has to edit your work finally. You know, I don't know any of us who are totally editors of our own work. The person who came the closest to that, two people for Back to God, were Ravinder Sarup and Sadaputta. Ravinder Sarup and Sadaputta's articles would get published almost exactly as they wrote them. I haven't seen anybody else's articles that's happened to. Now, Ravinder Sarup has a very unusual writing style, which is one reason it takes him 10 gazillion years to write something. He writes every sentence, he told me, 4 to 6 times. And it takes him hours and hours and hours to write a paragraph. So that's his particular style. The result of that is that he doesn't need much editing after it, if at all. So seriously, he would submit an article, and what we got submitted and what got printed were sometimes exactly identical. But it doesn't happen to anybody else. With everybody else, the editors go through and change it. And the editors especially change the part that you like the most that you wrote. But that was... You could have changed anything else on that one! That sentence, I was going to have it engraved! You know, and then the editors say, well, that's really like cutesy, huh? When you edit, you want to edit, of course, for meaning, for relevance, for meaning, and for clarity. The main thing that you generally have to, at least that I have to edit my work for, is mostly for clarity. So you want to look for meaning. Is am I saying what I want to say? Is it logical? Does it flow? Is it clear? Will somebody else understand, you know, will the package be delivered intact, basically? I'm unloading it from my mind onto the truck and then it gets offloaded into your mind. And do you get in your mind what I loaded in my mind? I find it always fascinating how people get very different messages from what I speak and what I write than my intention. Which is sometimes wonderful. I mean, sometimes you just sort of, wow, Krishna, that's interesting. They'll say, oh, I loved what you wrote because when you talked about this, I got this and this message. I'm like, I didn't put that in there. And sometimes it's wonderful. And you're just like, okay, Krishna, you know, you used me to tell somebody something, yes?
So you don't consider that a fail?
Oh, no, I consider that a success. Now, if people misunderstand what I say such that they get bewildered, that's a fail. But if people get something out of what I say that I didn't intend, but that's also Krishna conscious and it's also wonderful, yeah, that's fantastic. I love that. I don't mind Krishna using me in ways that of which I'm not aware. I don't mind that at all. I kind of think it's cool. So if there are, you know, collateral benefits that I wasn't aware at all, it happens quite a lot, in fact. Or I find that what people get the most out of is often something that for me was a little aside or a little tangent or a little, this is particularly more speaking than writing, but where it's something where it wasn't my main message.
Yeah.
It was a little tag. And sometimes it's that that really affects people. So I just kind of think that's cool. But I've got to do my part as Krishna's instrument to make sure that the meaning is clear, that there's good flow, that there's, again, engagement and interest. I'm really, again, looking for, is the reader going to be engaged? Are they going to want to finish the article? Is it something they can use? Is it something that they can remember?
So if a reader, for example, reads your article and gets a very sideline point, and it's not your major idea that you want to put forward, do you feel the need to try to push that idea forward?
No. I mean, if most of my readers did that most of the time, then I've got doing something wrong.
Yeah.
But if that happens sometimes, then I've come to trust that the readers and the hearers are who they're supposed to be and that Krishna arranges who's going to be there. And Krishna arranges what message they're going to get. And I've really learned to trust that, that I don't need to try to control that at all. I just need to be an instrument. And I'm going to let Krishna take care of that. I mean, some things are irritating. Armila, I love your articles. Oh,
which one?
I don't do that too often because it's kind of nasty. But every once in a while, I'm in a very demoniac mood and I do that. Oh, which one did you like the best? And then they'll take something written by somebody else. It's happened to me more times than I can count. I just had a lovely, lovely experience in Ermelo where this one, like, friend of the movement came to visit at the devotee's house where I was staying. And he said, Ermelo, I'm so happy to meet you after all these years. I've been reading your articles. And he went one after another after another. And when you wrote on this article, and then you said this, and you said that, and it really helped me with this, and really helped. And then that article you wrote about that, and I'm just like, wow. that's unusual. You know, that I felt like he practically memorized everything that I had written, and he was telling me the points I made and things I wrote 20, 25 years ago. And the different points I made and how it helped him in his life. Don't expect that very often. That's rare. Andy Stanley in his book tells a story with a speech rather than an article of how somebody remembered many, many years later, they'd forgotten his name, but they saw him somewhere. They said, didn't you give that speech way back? Oh yeah, he said. And then they repeated back to him the main one point of his speech. which was, if you want to know why, submit and apply. That was his main point. If you want to know why, submit and apply. The guide remembered it 10 years later, even though he'd forgotten the name of the speaker. So I see that as the ultimate success. Let people forget me. Everyone's going to forget me anyway. You're all going to be forgotten, my dear friends, except by God. Except by God, we're all going to be forgotten. I always ask people who remembers the name of their great-great-grandparents, and I hardly ever get anybody that does. That's our grandchildren's grandchildren. That's not that long from now. Our names will be forgotten. You know, but the message can still be there, and people can go on still. Somebody may not remember where they got that inspiration from, but then they'll go and repeat it to someone else, and people will be affected. Okay, the last point I wanted to make about editing is working with other editors and proofreaders. And it's probably one of the biggest challenges that we have as editors for Back to Godhead is that people don't like ever hearing that anything they've done is led anything less than perfect. And I see that our writing, it's kind of like our children, that people very much see their writing like their children. And as a teacher, one of the most difficult things was ever to tell anybody that there was anything wrong with their child. It's probably the most difficult part of being a teacher, that you have to meet with parents sometimes and say your child has a problem with this or your child has a problem with that. And most parents become very angry and very offended, and they may take their child out of the school and blame the school. It's just extremely difficult to tell parents there's something wrong with your child. And similarly, it's very difficult to tell writers that there's anything wrong with their writing. I've met so many devotees who said, well, I'll never write for Back to Godhead. Well, why not? Well, I wrote an article and it was rejected. And sometimes it wasn't even rejected. I've had people tell me that. Senior devotees. I wrote an article and it was rejected. And I said, Prabhu wasn't rejected. I said, we gave you 3 suggestions for minor changes. We loved the article. Well, it didn't sound to me that you loved it. You know, and this is a serious problem. That as soon as we tell somebody, make 3 minor changes, this sentence isn't clear, you know, this thing doesn't flow here, fix that. Oh, my article's been rejected. With that one devotee, I had to say, Prabhu, we really want to publish it. He said, well, I just can't fix it. And then I said, well, is it all right, Prabhu, if I fix it? I said, suppose I fix it, I show it to you, you approve, and then you can resubmit it with my fixing. He said, okay. So that's what we did. We ended up publishing it. But it seems to be such an ego thing. And look, I know what it feels like. I know what it feels like to have my favorite sentence in the piece and my favorite paragraph taken out and just go, okay. If that's the only way it's going to get published. And I know what it feels like. And I know what it feels like to have the other editors say, this part is not clear. And the worst for me anyway, the worst for my ego and my identity as a good devotee is when they say, this is bogus. That's wow.
Wait a minute, you've been told that?
Of course. That somebody will say, wait a minute, you know, I don't think this isn't philosophically sound. Of course they are.
Feed widely.
Huh? But no, I've put things in articles and some of the other editors will say, I don't think this is modified. Of course they have. We all say that to each other. We sure do. And that's very hard to take. It's very hard to take. You know, after a while it gets easier. Seriously, after a while you realize that that's one of the reasons you're submitting it to an editorial board, and you come to appreciate. I mean, I just recently was part of a group that had an interchange with one very senior devotee, and one GBC member on the group asked this very senior person, who is far junior to the GBC member and far junior to most of us on the group, what exactly are you doing? You've advertised that you're doing such and such program, and what exactly are you teaching? What exactly are you doing? And this person did not want to say what they were doing. Well, you come to the program and see for yourself. And the GBC member and other senior members said, please tell us exactly what you're doing. Describe it in a paragraph. The person wouldn't do it. And I wrote, I said, one of the benefits of being an ISKCON is that there are other people that are going to ask you, is this bona fide? What are you doing? What are you teaching? And you've either got to fix it or you've got to stop. And if you don't want to do that, then don't be an ISKCON and start your own movement, and then you don't have anybody asking you if it's bona fide, and then you can do what you want. And there are people who've done that. And most of them change something. Yes? So as writers, we need to be willing to have somebody say, I don't think that's bona fide. And you'll end up with a better piece of writing for it. Now, if you're not willing to be challenged, then start your own publication and don't work with editors and, you know, start your own blog and whatever. But I see it as a real benediction. Although the first few times it happens, it is hard. Me? Say something that's not bona fide? Of course not, I'm God. Everything I say is bona fide. You know? But, you know, I'm not God. I'm not God, and it's not that everything out of my mouth is Shastra. It's not that everything that comes out of my mouth is the absolute truth. It's not that all my realizations are the same as God. What a revelatory thought. No. And it's wonderful, and it's something to appreciate and to celebrate that we have other devotees who can say to us, is that bona fide? Is that bona fide? I was just in Bloomington, and it's a couple that run the center there. So the wife, not only does she arrange the bhoga beautifully on Krishna's plate, but she arranges the prasadam beautifully in the serve-out plates. So I said, this shows your high class. I said, low-class people, when they serve food, they ask, did you get enough? Middle-class people, they say, did it taste good? And high-class people, they said, did you like the arrangement? So her husband overheard me, and he came and he said, is that Shastra? I said, no, it's sociology. And he said, oh, was it okay that I asked? I said, no, please ask. I said, I should have said from the get-go what my source was. So we have a lot of articles submitted that are 90-95% from mundane sources. We have articles people submit that are coming from mundane sources and they try to justify it with Shastra. We won't print articles like that, Jim. And I'm sure people are offended. We say, I'm sorry, this is back to Godhead. It's got to be authorized. You've got to start with Shastra. You can't start with something else. You can bring in psychology. You can bring in sociology. You can bring in history. You can bring in science. That's fine. But you've got to start with Shastra. And generally, people get offended. And they're just like, you know, why do I have to be bona fide? Because you're writing for back to Godhead. That's why you have to be bona fide. But people get very, very offended. And I understand it because I have felt offended. You feel like someone's attacking your identity. And you feel like someone's attacking your integrity. And we want to have this mask that I'm a person of integrity. We're not people of integrity. We wouldn't be in the material world. Frankly, we're all criminals. Prabhupada said, if you're stealing a cucumber, you're stealing a diamond, you're still a thief. So it's a lot better to start out with the idea that I'm a criminal, I'm a person with zero integrity, and by Prabhupada's grace, I'm trying to become a person of integrity. And if somebody corrects me and somebody helps me to become the person of integrity and become who I really am and realize myself, that's helpful. But yeah, that's what it means to work with editors and proofreaders. And I know it's one of the reasons we have trouble finding writers. We have trouble getting enough information. Is that people do not like, they don't like to be told that what they've written is not relevant. They don't like to be told that what they've written is not bona fide. They don't like to be told that what they've written is poor writing. You know, but please, sorry to be so American, get over it. You know, really get over it. It is hard. It is so hard. Even people who have been writing for Back to Godhead for 25, 30 years still react with ego and defensiveness when they are corrected by the editors. Even sometimes among the editors that happens. Because some of us editors also write for the magazine. And sometimes even among us, if we say, is this bona fide, the person's hackles will rise and not defend themselves. So it's extremely, extremely difficult. When the editors, you know, say you should make a change, go and breathe for a while. Don't just write a reply or get on the phone, and, you know, if you feel defensive. Just go breathe. Go chant a few rounds and meditate on Krishna running in the fields of Vrindavan with Balaram. As seriously, just get away from it and maybe pray a bit. And Krishna, okay, let this... Because it is... I don't know exactly why it's so hard, but it seems to be extremely, extremely difficult. Of all the areas in which we have to correct people, their writing, I don't know, it's like it's me or something. It's me, and it's my integrity, and it's my identity, and it's my baby, and it's so hard. And one of the devotees who's both a regular writer and an editor, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu from Chaupati, who's I think he's in his 40s, brahmachari, and I've met him personally once. But he's an exemplar of what to do. So he submits, like all of us editors who also write, probably utmost a half of what he submits actually gets published. See, also most writers don't understand that. You know, if we reject one of their articles, they never want to write again. And I'll say to them, you know, we editors don't get all of our articles published. I have a whole stack, not literal anymore because it's electronic, but I have a whole stack of articles for BTG that have been rejected, that have not been published. I give you one example. I gave a class in Radhadesh, a regular Bhagavatam class, where the verse was about the Brahma Gayatri Mantra. That was the topic of that Bhagavatam verse. So it was a class for which I did an unusually large amount of research, much more than I generally do to give a Bhagavatam class. I spent many, many hours researching for that class. And I ended up taking my notes and putting them into the computer for a future class. And then I had a devotee who transcribed the class for me. And I took the class and made it into an article. So the other editors objected, we don't want an article in Bhakti Godhead about the Brahma Gayatri Mantra. We don't think this is a suitable topic for Bhakti Godhead. So obviously I disagreed, or else I wouldn't have written it. But they weren't willing to run it. And then I said, well, suppose I wrote another four articles about the other, so it'd be about all five aspects of diksha. Then could you run it? They said yes, but I haven't done it. You know, I haven't sat down and written the other four articles. So that article's never been published. They just said, we don't think the topic is suitable for our audience. Even though I said, well, most of our audience are Indians, and most Indians have heard of the Brahma Gayatri Mantra. There's tons of YouTube videos where people are singing it. You know, it's a very known mantra. I said our audience are the Hindus and the New Age yoga types. They've practically all heard of the Brahma Gayatri Mantra. Why not give our Krishna conscious explanation of it? Why not give our shastra? But they weren't convinced. So, you know, another one ages ago, oh my God, this is eons ago, I wrote an article about how to teach Sanskrit, and Jai Doitamara said, again, I don't think that's a suitable topic for Bhakti Gaya. So Chaitanya Charan is one of the persons who really exemplifies that we can say to him, this isn't a suitable topic, it isn't shastric enough, you know, it has problems with philosophy, it has problems with this, and he'll just say, okay, and he never gets offended, and he never argues back, and he goes on and submits, either he fixes it or he discards it and goes on and writes something else.
He's a brilliant writer. I'm a big fan of
him. He is a brilliant writer. But you should know that a lot of his articles went through a lot of changes before they were published. And there was a lot of back and forth, and there was a lot of editing. And many of his articles have gone through four and five drafts with the editors, plus the final editing from Nagaraj before they get published. And he's very open and humble in that process, which the rest of us, I must say, are not always.
But that's why it's so good at the end.
Yes. And I try to explain this to other writers. I mean, I don't remember which one it was, but there was one article that I submitted that went through six drafts, and then it was rejected. It never even got published. You know, the editors would say, make this change, this. So I'd make the change, and I would come up with another draft. No. So, oh, it was a Sanskrit article. I went through six drafts. And finally, Jayadeva Jamarish just said, you know, I don't like the topic. Could have told me that in the first place. But I don't think he knew that in the first place. You know, at first he said, there's not enough Prabhupada. So then I, like, saturated it with Prabhupada. And then he said, there's too much Prabhupada. Okay. You know, and really, I mean, completely, six completely different drafts, not six tweakings. Six completely different drafts. I have an article on sex desire that still hasn't gotten published.
But all this is encouraging for us.
You know, I wrote the article on sex desire, and I included in it two or three sentences about polygamy. So because of that, the other editors rejected it entirely. They said, we don't want anything about polygamy in Back to God. And I'm like, oh, it's all over the Bible. Tell me. Okay, fine. So then they said, you have to restructure it. And I decided, I was debating, okay, what do I do? Do I just rewrite the article? Because I was also giving it as a seminar. Or do I work on the seminar? So then I spent, I don't know how many hours, at least 50 or 60 hours, working on the seminar, and I put together a whole multimedia presentation in which I don't mention polygamy. But anyway, I put together a whole multimedia presentation on sex desire. So now I have to take the presentation and turn it back into an article. And I just haven't done it yet. So it still hasn't gotten published. But that was also a few drafts, and I mean, it was a big argument about, you know, what should be in there. Okay, I'll take out those two sentences. All right, fine. But no, we don't want it structured like this, and you have to put in more Shastra. There's not enough Shastra, and you're not substantiating this point. And this, you know, it's a very touchy subject. And now that I've worked on the seminar and I've given the seminar, I can finally give the seminar without embarrassment. Thank you, Krishna. First time just recently I gave a seminar without. Just cool. It's just cool. It's like, wow, I finally given this seminar, and I've just stayed cool the whole time. I don't believe it. So maybe now I can. But it's been a long journey. And this is years. Years. From the time I first gave class on 525.5 in Auckland as my regular Bhagavatam class, and the devotees came up to me afterwards and says, oh my God, Amelia, you have to turn this into an article in a seminar. And now that it's my multimedia seminar, and now trying to turn that back into an article, I'd like to have it published. I think it's important. I'd like to do it. And then how to get it past the editors. You know? So there's things like that. You know? It just is what it is. And sometimes it's very frustrating, and sometimes you think, you know, should I publish it in another media? Or the one I got published on offering Dandavat. Thank you, Krishna, that got published. So some of the editors said, well, you're making a couple political statements in this article, which I did. And, you know, the one of the editors said, okay, well, as long as you just say it's my opinion, then we'll let it in. Because some of them were saying, take it out. I'm like, if you take it out, then I don't even want to publish this. Okay, we can put it in and you negotiate. And you've got to be willing to go through the process where you may have to write the entire article over. You may have to start it completely over. You may have to have a different premise. You may have to have a... My Karna article, I think three drafts. Three completely different drafts. Three completely different rewrites of that article. I love that article. One of my favorite articles that I've written. So if you're not willing to do that, then you're not really going to have something that's high quality. And I see that as, I mean, Chaitanya Charan wrote something once to the editorial staff that he sees that as a great blessing that he gets to work with the other editors and that he gets to have this kind of help with his writing. And you end up with something, definitely, most of the time, you end up with something that's far, far, far better. I mean, sometimes I think it would have been better with that, but generally... Sometimes I'm like, it would have been much better the way I had written it in the first place. But generally, you appreciate that what you have is something so much more first class. And like, I was just able to publish this book on Amazon of my chanting articles, and they were already edited. You know, I thought, wow, this is really nice. It's a great opulence.
that it went through this process. I hope I answered all of your points. When I first looked at this list, I was like, 3 hours I'm going to talk about all that stuff. Anything else that anybody want to ask? I'm sure there's a lot more I could say, but yes.
In your structure, when you start up with me, how personal do you make your article? For example, if you're talking about raising good children, would you talk about your children?
I have. I took a real risk. Do you have to leave?
I have to pick up my daughter. Thank you so much. It's very inspiring.
Thank you for coming on a weekday. For 3 hours.
Thank you.
Hopefully there were at least one or two things you could pick up.
Thank you so much.
I took a real risk recently. Yeah, I come around this way. Don't worry about walking behind me. Just look at her behind me.
Thanks.
As part of getting my PhD, I had to do an internship where I worked in a government school. And it was in the Bible Belt of America, where if I had been open that I was a devotee, I would have been fired. And if I was fired, I wouldn't have gotten my degree. So I really needed to keep that job, and I really needed to hide the fact that I was a devotee. So it was a very delicate balancing act for me. And it was a very humbling experience for me. Because it's so easy to say to people, just be Krishna conscious at work, if you've never tried to be Krishna conscious at work. Yes, I wrote an article about that. Now, what that article was that as part of my internship for college, we had to write essays about our internship. And one of the essays we had to write was this very personal essay. I was inspired to publish it because it's one of the main questions I get everywhere in the world. How do you be Krishna conscious in a job? It's one of the number one questions that I get. And I was also inspired to write it because I saw that most of the people answering that question didn't have a clue as to what the answer was. That the vast majority of our preachers has never been Krishna conscious in a job because they've never had a job. And so they don't know what they're talking about, just frankly. They don't know what they're talking about. And I realized that because I realized that I didn't know what I was talking about. Starting about a year before I did the internship, when people asked me that question, I started to say, well, let me do it first and then I'll tell you. There's a story of Prabhupada tells in Chaitanya Charitamrita when Sankaracharya was debating, and in those days when there were debates, first of all, people knew when they were defeated, which now they don't know anymore when they're defeated, but when they were defeated, they'd become the disciple of the person who defeated them. And becoming a disciple of Sankaracharya meant you took sannyas. I mean, it was a pretty serious thing. And you took Mayavadi sannyas. I mean, it was heavy. You engage in a debate with Sankaracharya, and you were betting your life. So Sankaracharya debated with this one king, and the judge was the queen. So you just imagine how qualified she was. She must have, A, known all the shastras thoroughly, B, been detached enough to say whether or not her husband lost the debate, which would mean he would take sannyas. Hare Krishna. This idea of Vedic women as being just sort of, you know, roti rolling, nappy changing, brainless. Anyway, so it's obviously not the case. So she was the judge of the debate, and after the debate she says, my husband has lost this debate. She said, but I am half of his body, and until you defeat me, my husband has not lost. Sankaracharya said, you're right. Now Sankaracharya had said that he would debate on any part of the scriptures. So then she said, all right, I want to debate on the Kama Shastras. I want to debate on what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada calls in the purport the erotic principles, because the Shastra talks about everything. So Prabhupada writes that Sankaracharya had taken sannyas when he was 8, and therefore he said, I'm not capable of debating on the Kama Shastras because I have no personal experience. He said, give me a month. So he left. He went with one disciple into a cave. He left his body. He entered into the body of a dying king. Prabhupada tells his stories in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He enters into the body of a dying king. In the body of the dying king, as Prabhupada puts it, he enjoyed the erotic principles. Then after a month, he left the body of a king, entered back into his own body of Sankaracharya, went back and debated with the queen, defeated the queen, at which time the queen took up a life of renunciation. Prabhupada says she gave up material life. when I researched it, I was thinking, did that mean she died, or does that mean she became a renunciate? But it appears that she became a renunciate and actually started her own ashram. Point is, if you haven't experienced something, you can't talk about it. And we have a lot of harm in our movement from people who preach about things without any personal experience. There's a lot of harm being done in a Hare Krishna movement of people who have no experience about something, they don't know what they're talking about, and they talk about it. So that's another thing, only write about what you have experience with. So I felt that because I did have this experience, that it would be very valuable for me to share that experience with the devotees, because it's one of the greatest needs in a Hare Krishna movement. So I decided that I was going to really risk, that article is the biggest risk that I've ever taken, that I was really going to risk being vulnerable. Because a lot of what I revealed in that article was how much I struggled, how difficult it was for me, how a lot of my ideas were smashed to smithereens, a lot of my so-called theories.
I think that's what made the impact.
Yes. Yeah. But it was a big risk. That wasn't an easy thing for me to decide to publish. I mean, I made a few changes from what I had originally written for my professors. I wrote a little intro to it, and I changed some of a little bit of the wording, because I was writing for a devotee audience instead of a non-devotee audience. But it was... I'm glad I did it. You know, I think to make yourself vulnerable and honest in the service of the devotees is something very worthwhile. Now, of course, we don't benefit anybody just by telling them how fallen we are. That doesn't benefit anybody. You know, revealing your mind in confidence doesn't mean say, okay, let me tell you about all the nonsense I thought about today. That's not. We should speak in a way that's beneficial for others. The main reasons of revealing frailties or difficulties is for connection. And we find, you know, like Bilva Mangala, the story of Bilva Mangala Thakur, Narada Muni tells this story how he fell down from the heavenly planets. The story of Jed Bharat, so many stories of Indra. Ooh, poor Indra. How would you like to have the stories of your fall downs in the Bhagavad Gita? You know? Wow. You know, I was just reading about how Indra steals Prithu Maharaj's 100th horse because he's envious of Prithu. How dare anybody have 100 horse sacrifices? Let him only have 99. You know? And he dresses up like a sannyasi. Oh my God. At least my envy is mostly just known to God. My embarrassing stories, you know. I one time was on a phone call and I said something so arrogant on the phone. Oh my God, what I said. And my daughter and son-in-law were there, and as soon as the words came out of my mouth, they looked at me. And all of a sudden I went, and every once in a while, my son-in-law still teases me about it. And sometimes he almost repeats it to other people. I say, don't you dare tell anybody what I said. You know, so it's not that we have to go out there and reveal, you know, where I said this thing that showed that I was the most arrogant person. You know? I mean, it's like, wow. But we do need to let people be comfortable with facing their own frailties. Because unless and until you can face your own frailties and your own desires, you can't advance. You can't advance if you pretend to be something you're not. You just can't. You can't get anywhere. I always give the example, you can't get direction someplace unless you give your position. How do I get to the temple? Where are you? If you give a false position, I'll give you false directions. So when you're teaching people, a lot of what you have to do in the very beginning is you've got to get people to be honest, at least internally. It's not that they have to externally reveal stuff, although sometimes I will do that. But people at least have to reveal in their own mind and their own heart to themselves what their crying needs are. what their struggles are, what their desires are. Like these three devotees I saw last night, give me blessings. What do you want? And they had no clue what they wanted. You've got to do that. And one of the best ways to do that is to model it. Especially if you're dealing with something that's very embarrassing. Again, you don't want to pollute people's minds with the trash that's in your own minds. We all have trash in our minds, yes? Would any of us take the transcript of our mind and put it on the internet? I don't think so. So it's not that we should do that either. So I don't need to tell you all the time since I joined the Hare Krishna movement that I forgot Krishna, that I offended devotees, you know, that I thought maybe I'd like to eat that chocolate bar I enjoyed when I was a kid. I haven't yet, but I've thought about it. So, you know, I did one time eat a chocolate bar. No, it wasn't chocolate, it was a carrot bar when I was out on Sankirtan. But we don't need to do that. But we do need to show people that we are real. If we want them to be real, we've got to be real. You're not real, you're not going to get them to be real. And then we all go on, it's a superficial thing, and nobody gets anywhere. That we all pretend that we're advancing and we're not advancing, and that's not worth anything, or very little. That's worth something, I suppose. Because at least there's some idea, and then maybe someday we'll actually do what we're pretending to do. So it's worth something. I mean, Putin made it by pretending, but generally, you know, it's not a very good. We're not in the Putina Sampradaya. So just, you know, that's not what you really want to do. And if you're not authentic, it's very hard to get other people to be authentic. It's very, 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 very difficult. So you have to find ways of being authentic without contaminating other people. Do you understand what
yes.
I'm saying?
Yes.
I have to authentically say, yeah, I struggle with this. This is an issue for me. But I'm not going to share the details of my struggle and the details of my issue. That's not going to help you. It's not going to help me. It's not going to help you. Now, maybe I'll share that with somebody that I'm particularly close to that can, but that's not public. That doesn't benefit you. Okay? Now, occasionally, I will share details if they're such that they will benefit people. You have to gauge. Like, there's a story that I tell publicly a lot about how one of my students was from Nepal, and he gave me this gorgeous chatter that his mother had sent from Nepal. It was just beautiful. Oh, my mother has sent you. And I thought, oh, he's giving it to me because he's so grateful that I'm his teacher, and, you know, he's just... It's because I'm so wonderful. I mean, I went on and on in my mind about how wonderful I was, and that therefore I was getting this beautiful chatter because I was the most wonderful person in the whole universe, and I had this whole thing. I didn't know I was doing that, but that's what I was doing. And then I wore the chatter to the temple in the morning. Now, men probably won't relate to this. This is a very female thing. I wore the chatter to the temple in the morning, and every other woman had the same chatter. See, I don't think the men are bothered if every man in the temple has the same kurta. That's not the kind of thing that men envy. But when every woman had the same chakra, everybody. And I was so upset. You know, I sat down to chant my japa and I couldn't chant. Couldn't chant. And then finally, you know, when I started to chant, it was just as soon as I started chanting, Krishna said, "This is envy." And it was so shocking to me. I didn't realize that I was envious. You know, all those years in the movement, oh, yes, 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 we're all full of envy, and envy is the root of our rebellion against Krishna, and that's why we're not Krishna conscious, because, oh, yes, 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 and of course that must mean I'm envious, but I didn't know I was envious. I had no idea. It was all theory. It was all some concept that I was just saying. And Krishna said, "You're envious. That's what this is. It's envy." And I was like, oh, my God, I really am envious. I'm so envious. I have to have a better charter than every other lady in the temple. No one's allowed to have as nice a charter as I have. So I'll tell that specific story. I don't mind telling that story. You follow? Mm-hmm. So there are certain things. It depends what it is. And I try to get to the point where we should try to get to the point where we kind of get over ourselves and we're not so worried about what everybody else thinks of us, and who cares, really. my grandchildren's grandchildren will not even remember my name. And so, you know, if somebody doesn't like me right now, it doesn't matter. Everybody will forget me in a few years anyway. Seriously. Really seriously. It just doesn't matter. One devotee wrote me this thing today. Somebody had written some really nasty article about me on Sampradaya Sun, and somebody had copied onto Facebook, and they were writing all these lies about me on Facebook, and should I go and defend myself? And I'm like, why? Why? They won't listen to me anyway. And Urmila thinks this, and I wish he'd never even told me. You know, Urmila thinks this. I'm glad you know what I'm thinking. Okay, that's cool. That's cool. They didn't ask me. Nobody asked me. Urmila, what are you thinking? Urmila's thinking this, and she has this motive, and she's done this, and I heard she even did this, and I heard she also did this. I'm like, oh, that's really funny. So, you know, it's some kind of a balance. We want to write in such a way that people are benefited and that they're uplifted. That people, when they read what we write, when they hear what we say, they should feel inspired and they should feel uplifted. They shouldn't feel depressed. They shouldn't feel dirty. You know? Like Prabhupada said, don't show pictures of people killing cows in Bhaktivedanta. He said, we're against meeting, but that doesn't mean we show pictures of killing cows. He said, that will pollute people's consciousness. He said, just like we're against illicit sex, we're not going to put pictures of illicit sex. It's like, oh yeah, that's true. So, you know, don't put pictures of cow killing out for people. You want to elevate them. You want your writing to be sattva-guna. At the same time, you have to be truthful and you have to be authentic and you have to be real. You've got to be real. People are so appreciative when someone is real. Prabhupada said all sorts of interesting things about himself, which if you try to deify Prabhupada, they won't make any sense to you. Prabhupada's not God, he's a jiva. And Prabhupada said, when my business failed, he said, when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati told me to preach in the Western world, I thought, okay, if I'm going to do that, first I have to make a lot of money, which is a common mistake that we make. He said, first I have to make a lot of money. So he said, I didn't do it right away. He said, that was my mistake. He said, so I started a business and tried to make a lot of money. He said, then when I was ready to preach, the business failed. He said, so I was thinking I must have made some mistake and Krishna's displeased with me and therefore he made the business fail. He said, then I realized, oh, Krishna's taking away everything to help me and Krishna wants me to start the movement in another way. So Prabhupada was talking about his process of thinking and his process of coming to an understanding. And I take that as just real. I just take it as it is. I don't interpret it. I don't look at that and interpret that. Well, Prabhupada didn't really think like that and he didn't really feel like that. He's just pretending to feel it. I don't take it like that. I take that Prabhupada was being very honest. And Prabhupada said, I didn't want to take sannyas. Said, I was terrified of taking sannyas. Prabhupada had been away from his family already for 4 years. He said, I didn't want to take sannyas. He said, my guru forced me. He kept insisting, take sannyas, take sannyas. My god brothers forced me. He said, we're all afraid of giving up our family. And I take it that Prabhupada was genuinely talking about how he felt. And he was genuinely being authentic that that's how he felt. And giving us a template or how we respond when Krishna takes away something that we feel is useful for our service, or how we respond when Krishna pushes us to something that we feel is beyond our capability to do. And Prabhupada said when he came to America, you know, the first few months, nobody came. He had nothing. He wasn't getting anywhere. And he said, I would go back to the boatyard every 2 months and say, when's the next boat back to India? So again, I take that as real. Take that as Prabhupada's being very genuine with us. And that's, you know, the first time I met Srila Prabhupada, I first saw him on the Vyasasam preaching as the Acharya, and there was no difference between that and listening to a recording. The experience was identical in every respect. There was not one iota of difference between, I was standing as close to Prabhupada as I'm to you, and I was fanning him during the class. And listening to Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasana and listening to a recording. It was 100% identical, which was lovely because that meant Prabhupada had always been there in his recordings and he'd still be there in his recordings when he left. But I also wanted something more. So I was with this. Well, this is wonderful that that Prabhupada's always been here. But at the same time, I wanted something personal. And later, we got to meet Prabhupada in his room, and we really saw Prabhupada not as the acharya, but as the person, as the individual jiva, as the person. And he was in a very casual mood. It was very sweet, and that you can't get on Earth. It's a different thing. But Prabhupada, I mean, when people ask me to describe Prabhupada in one word, my answer is that he was authentic. He was genuine. He was real. You know, and Prabhupada was equally real. If somebody said, you know, have you seen Krishna? And he said, yes, I'm seeing Krishna at every moment. And when he said, I didn't want to take sannyas, I was terrified. I didn't want to leave my family. I didn't want to take sannyas. Those are both real. Yes, I'm seeing Krishna at every moment. Yes, there's never a time. I remember I was there when the recorder said, Prabhupada, Swamiji, at what age did you realize the highest truth? Prabhupada said that. I cannot say from the age. He said, I've never forgotten Krishna. Always remember Krishna. But at what age? At what age, Swamiji? I cannot say from the age. I know there's no age. But, well, Swamiji, if you had to give an age, what age was there that you became enlightened? Oh, if I have to give an age, then 4 or 5 years. So Prabhupada was very authentic in that respect. And he was also very authentic in saying, I thought I had offended Krishna, and I thought I made a mistake, and that's why my business failed. And then I understood, oh, Krishna wanted in another way. Is that all right? This whole world is full of phonies. The whole world, it's all full of pretense. This whole world is just a bunch of pretenders. We're all pretending to be something we're not. Yeah, well, we put all this energy into our masks and our personas. Yes? Even in our Hare Krishna movement. I am a good devotee. I am a loyalist ISKCON member. I am a good devotee. You know? And I mean, that's useful in the beginning. It's useful. It's better than the mask of I'm a materialist or whatever, but at a certain point, you know, we're dying for authenticity. Yes? We're dying for it. We want truth. It has to be beneficial. Austerities of speech. Truthful, beneficial, pleasing. So I'm sure it would apply to writing. Truthful, beneficial, pleasing. Language is not agitating to others and based on the Vedas. So it's got to be true, it's got to be based on the Vedas. The language has to be pleasing, which is why poetry is such a good thing. The content and the message has to be pleasing. And it's got to be beneficial. It's got to benefit you as the writer, and it's got to benefit your readers. So that's your main question to ask. Will people be benefited? Yes, it's true. Yes, it's based on the scriptures. I've used beautiful language. The content is pleasing. Will people be benefited? That's your question. And if people will be benefited, if they'll genuinely be benefited, then being a little humble is not a bad thing. There's no harm with being humble if it will benefit others. If it will not benefit others, then don't. You have to, you know, share what will benefit others. And that's the same with your good things. You know, with your struggles and with your victories. We don't share all of our victories either. Some realizations, some victories, some wonderful things about ourselves, some wonderful things about a Krishna consciousness are just as private and just as not shareable as some of the horrible, horrible thoughts that go through our mind. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? It's not that if you're chanting japa and, you know, Krishna comes and gives you a hug that you write about that and publish it. You may call up your good friend and say, oh my God! You never believe what happened to me in Japa today. I realized Krishna is his name. I had one of my good friends one time call me and say, mother-in-law, you know how they're always saying that chanting Hare Krishna is sweet? Yeah. Well, it actually is. She said, it's not just a metaphor. She said, the holy name has a sweet taste. And I was tasting the sweetness. But you don't necessarily say that in public. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I mean, I meet devotees that have amazing spiritual experiences, unbelievable spiritual experiences. So I met one devotee who told me, she said, well, I was chanting japa, she said, all of a sudden Lord Varaha came and I could feel his skin, it was like velvet. But if that's your experience, you probably don't put that in an article that goes out in public. And you probably don't say that from the Vyasa side. Maybe you say it to your friend. Do you understand?
I'm writing a column on stories, short stories. And I try not to put too much philosophy, because you were saying that when there's storytelling, there should be some philosophy.
Definitely.
But I try to put philosophy through the story.
It should be interwoven into the story.
Yes.
Well, if you're very expert at storytelling, you can... It depends who your audience is. If you're very expert at storytelling, you can weave the philosophy in subtly. I mean, all those books I wrote for children, I really avoid preaching in the stories. I wanted people who are not devotees to be willing to buy them. And my assumption was that if devotee parents and devotee teachers are using the books, they can add their own preaching. That I wasn't. They, you know, they're very simple stories for very young children. But Prabhupada did not just tell stories without philosophy. He just didn't. He simply didn't. I'm not saying that we can never do that. I'm not saying that it's some kind of a rule. But I'm simply noting that Prabhupada did not do that. As far as I know, he never did it. I mean, we developed a policy in Back to God that we will not just print stories without any philosophy. Especially summaries of stories without philosophy. They're not even fun to read, you know. I mean, that book, The Dream Manager, 95% of that book is just a story. It's simply a story. It's a story of this company and how they went from barely making it financially to being a huge success by caring for the employees and fulfilling the dreams of the employees. But it's just a story. Then at the very end of the book, there's some practical advice as to what you can do in your own life and what you can do in your own business to put these principles into action. And I'd say it's the only management book I've ever read, and I've read many, 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 that was just a story. Usually they'll make points and have a story. And it was just one story. I kept expecting that at the end of that chapter they'd go on to give another example, or they'd, you know, it was a very unusual, but it was very powerful. I mean, I cried several times when I was reading that. It was so powerful. And I thought, wow, you know, if we could organize our own movement like this, if we could organize society, you know, if the world was organized like this, if the government leaders and the parents and all the leaders had this sort of a focus. Maybe not in that kind of details, but not necessarily exactly specifically what they did, but that kind of principle. The most effective means of teaching anything is through stories. There simply is not a more effective means of teaching than through stories. It doesn't exist. As I say, all of our scriptures are stories. I mean, not the Isha Upanishad. The whole Bhagavatam is stories. And it's a story, you know, you've got the big story of the sages at Namasharanya, you've got the story of Maharaj Prakrit, and it's a story within a story within a story within a story within, and sometimes overlapping. And psychologists have analyzed that the most effective stories are stories within stories within stories. And they're really stories. You know? There's a snake bird coming to bite Prakrit. I mean, they're exciting stories. The more you get into them, the more you wish they were made into a Hollywood movie or something. Fog out. So that's another seminar I have. Why stories are so effective. I'll probably ever ask to teach that one. I haven't taught it for years and years and years. But I have a seminar on how to develop, how to write fables, how to write and tell fables and metaphorical stories. And the value. Nobody ever asked me for that.
We'll ask you next time.
I have to take a lot of review with it because I teach it so rarely. But, you know, what is the value, particularly of fiction? What is the value of metaphor, of fable, of analogy? Why is it so effective at teaching philosophy? Philosophy, values, behavioral changes. And how do you do it? How do you create metaphors to teach what you want to teach. Okay, we are past our time. Should we end now?
Yes, we should.
Okay.
Unless somebody has some pressing, burning question.
It's got to be pressing and burning.
I used to be on fire.
No, seriously, does anyone have something that they'd really like to ask? Yes, you do. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I want to know if you could please give me some advice on what I should do or what I should read to be able to prepare to write what you want to
get. There's a book called The Student's Writer's Handbook by Susan Sorensen, which goes through every possible type of writing that anybody could do in their life other than a full-on novel, and gives you guidance step by step as to how to write it. The Student Writer's Handbook by Susan Sorensen. You should be able to get it on Amazon. And it's just a manual for any kind of writing that you could possibly do. And then you also want to study something about APA style, because we use APA style. And I think when you go there, assume that you need help and ask for it, and take it from this. We have a lot of things set up in place where there's different people at the college who will help the students with their writing, but a lot of students don't make use of it, and then they turn in papers that are just awful because they haven't made use of it. So the things that people really struggle with there are, you know, how to organize a paper so that it has a beginning, middle, and end, so it has an introduction, body, and conclusion, how to have proper transitions between your thoughts, how to develop your arguments, having enough citations, knowing when to cite, knowing when not to cite, knowing how to cite. So those are the main things that I see people struggling with. And then sometimes just basic grammar and spelling, which there's just no excuse for not having that, right? You know, there's absolutely no excuse for getting a spelling. I mean, how does anyone have an excuse for having misspellings anymore?
Wow. I'm not going to comment on that.
Really, I mean, with spell checkers, there really just is no excuse for that. So that kind of thing. Thank you very, very much. If I've said anything that offended anybody, please excuse me. And I hope I've said something that was of use and of value.
Thank you. You were very authentic.
I try. I really try. I have found that being authentic is such a relief. Such a relief. It's one of our deepest needs, is for truth and authenticity. We don't have to be afraid. We really don't have to be afraid. What we have to be afraid of is Maya. We have to be afraid of being pretenders. My big writing project I'm working on now is publishing Raghunath Das Goswami's Mana Shiksha. So we've gotten all the Sanskrit verses translated. We've gotten all of Bhaktivinoda Thakura's song commentaries translated first time. And we've gotten now 10 out of the 12 prose commentaries of Bhaktivinoda translated. They're going through checking right now. Then we've gotten all of Satchinanda Maharaj's seminars on Mana Shiksha transcribed. We've gotten Bhaktivigyan Swami's, sure how many he's got. It looks like we've got about 25 or 30 seminars, because he often gave three at different times on one verse. We're going to have to combine them. It's going to be an editor's nightmare. But we've gotten those translated from Russian to English and transcribed. And Radhanath Swami says he's going to be writing commentary. Then we've got six artists who are going to do 116 black and white drawings, and one artist who's going to do 12 color drawings. And in one of the Mana Shiksha is a guidebook for entering into higher stages of bhakti. It's a step-by-step guidebook. It's one of Bhaktivinoda Thakura says there's two guidebooks for the higher stages of bhakti. And the other one, which is the one that devotees tend to know about, doesn't seem to me to be really suitable for Prabhupada's movement. It isn't a preaching, work in the world kind of guidebook. So I see Mana Shiksha as being very important. And it's very interesting that Raghunath Das Goswami really emphasizes giving up deceit. That the main thing that has to be given up before one fully enters into Krishna's lila is deceit. And he talks about how, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, especially in his commentary, talks about how the desire for fame and honor is what causes us to take up various pretensions. So I see it like there's this tree, and the root of the tree is this desire for fame and honor. And then on all the branches are all these masks. And because I want to be famous and I want to be honored, then I pretend to be somebody I'm not. So the people will honor me for what I'm not, because I know I can't be honored for what I am. I know if I'm honestly who I am, nobody's going to honor me, and I'm not going to be famous, because I'm a little teeny tiny soul that everybody's going to forget about in a few years, and that my ability to be a controller and to have any influence and to have any meaning other than love for Krishna isn't there. My only meaning is as a lover of Krishna. My only meaning is as a servant of Krishna. And that's beautiful, and it's eternal, and it's wonderful, but it's very small. It's very small, you know, and my eternal service may be just giving a flower garland to a gopi, you know. I mean, it's, and because we want honor above what we are and different from what we are, we take all these masks. And we suffer. It's just suffering. And then you got to feed the mask, and you got to maintain it, you got to remember which mask you're wearing. And, you know, and it's not satisfying. It's just not satisfying to have relationships with other people, none of whom is being authentic, and everyone's wearing a mask, and you're relating with. C.S. Lewis actually wrote that in another one of his books. He wrote it actually in regard to birth control. He wrote it that when husband and wife are using birth control, they're not actually having sex with each other. They're having sex with like a parody of each other. They're not actually connecting. You know, literally a lot of contraceptives is a literal barrier. It's a physical barrier. It's a psychological barrier. So all of our dealings with each other, it's you know, my mask relating with your mask. And that until we uproot this desire for honor, we keep doing these pretenses. And as long as we do these pretenses, that's the last thing. That's the last thing. He talks about giving up all these different inartas, you know, letting go, and then it's the last thing. And when you give up that, then Krishna says, okay, now you're mine. And then you get under the control of the internal energy. Okay? Mahatmanastumam parthardhaibhi prakriti mashrita. Radharani, the internal energy. It's at that point that Krishna turns you over to Radharani and says, now you're under the control of the internal energy. But you have to get rid of the pretenses. And you can't get rid of the pretenses as long as you want to be honored for something you're not. So and we go on even as devotees in the Hare Krishna movement. We take off the mask that we had when we were materialists, and then we put on these other ones. I am a good devotee. Yeah, isn't it? How dare you say that I'm not... I mean, it's so silly, because on the one hand, we say, yes, I'm so fallen. Well, I'm not a pure devotee, Prabhu. Okay, well, this is how you're not a pure devotee. How dare you say I'm not a pure devotee? You know, it's... Isn't it? How dare you say I had something in my article that wasn't bona fide? But I thought you just said you're not a pure devotee.